Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. Please consider becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to Labyrinths ad-free.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson to learn more.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So we got a knock on the door at midnight and, come to Docton. There's been an accident. And we had had breakfast with him that morning. And he told me he was taking his friends and another boat of friends over to the Tacoma Dome for bull riding. And I thought, what kind of an accident? And in the back of my head, I already knew he was dead.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is Labyrinths.
In the last few episodes of Labyrinths, we've dealt with stories of death and emergency in a medical context.
The deaths that occur in the ER and the ICU don't often seem like ideal deaths, even if doctors like Kat Moore from last episode are taking cues from Zen Buddhism.
So when we picked up our local paper the other day and saw an article about the death doulas who serve our small community on Vashon Island, we picked up the phone.
Today's guest is Susan Pittiger, and Susan is a death doula. What exactly is a death doula?
A death doula is a person who companions someone who's dying and their family through all of the realities of death, the physical death, the spiritual death, the emotional death. And I support the person who's dying and the family looking at all those things.
That's huge. So if someone were to say, I'm a doula, typically we think of you're the person who's there accompanying the mom as she's about to give birth. How would you say being a death doula compares to being a birth doula?
For me, birth doulas and death doulas are both sacred. I mean, death and birth are sacred. Many death doulas have been birth doulas. So we're welcoming in a new life and we're helping exit a life.
How did you ever hear about this profession? Were you always aware that death doulas were a thing, or did you come across this idea at some point in your life?
I had always been very interested in hospice, and they offer immense help to the dying. But I have a Sufi teacher, Bodhi B, who is also a death doula, and he started offering death doula classes, and I just said yes.
What made you interested in hospice care?
Well, I'm a nurse by profession. That's what I do. My death doula is an offering to my community. I read something about where hospice started. It started in the Crusades. For the Crusaders who were traveling across Europe or back home who got too ill to make it. And hospices sprung up mainly in churches to help them die, be with them, support them as they died. And I just always found that fascinating.
So, wow, this profession or this work, this service goes back a long time. But how common is it?
It's becoming more common.
Okay.
In the Seattle area, there's probably 20 death doulas. And each death doula offers different things. I mean, they're, you know, some are very religious and they're offering like from a Buddhist point of view or a Zen point of view or an Arabic point of view. I mean, they have different points of views.
Do you have a point of view in your approach, or are you more just familiar with all of the traditions and try to navigate whatever tradition the dying person and their family might belong to?
I definitely want to honor the traditions of the person. I do not feel that I can offer anything specific. if I don't know enough about their tradition, I ask.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who died, and she had a specific piece of information that was typically read at the deathbed. And her congregation, she was Christian of some sort, wasn't available. So I got the piece of paper. And when she died, I read that piece of paper. So whatever comes up.
When do you typically come into a person's life? When are you called upon as a death doula?
Hopefully, I'm contacted by the person or the family when they know that death is coming imminently in the next 6 months or less.
Okay. And why do you say hopefully?
Because some people wait until the very end, and then I'm not that helpful.
Right. Because what's involved, like what's part of the process? If in your ideal situation, when you have 6 months of the last part of a person's life, what do you do in those 6 months? How do you guide them?
I always start out with, do you have all your paperwork in order? Do you have an advanced care directive? Do you know how you want to die? Do you know where you want to die? What's going to happen with your body after you die? Do you have your will in place? Does your family know where all your paperwork is? Do they know all your passwords? Just the have-tos. Hopefully, it makes it easier for the person to let go, knowing that all of those issues are taken care of, so they can then concentrate on death. And knowing that their family knows and their family's taken care of.
And then after all of those things are taken care of, what happens next?
I classically will sit with the family and talk about what's coming up, talk with the patient, saying, how do you want to die? Do you want to die in this bed? Do you want to die with a special view, special foods? Do you want to have music when you're dying? Do you want to have a darkness or lightness? I mean, just try to have them understand what it is that will make them most comfortable. And that can change. You know, what you think now is going to make you comfortable can be not the way it has to be. I also talk about legacy letters. Do you want to write a letter to your grandchildren telling them who you are and what you want to give them from your soul? You know, do you want to write legacy letters to your wife, your spouse, your children, your best friends? I don't know. That's a piece of giving of yourself that we don't often think about.
What do you do when you might be called upon by a person who's in denial of their death? And I ask this question because a part of me feels like the vast majority of us spend our entire lives in denial about our death. And I wonder how common it is, even up to the very end, that we hold on to this denial.
It is something that we can go to our death denying it. And I've found that the more acceptance you have of your death, the more peaceful your death is.
And how do you get somebody to a place of accepting their death?
Sometimes you don't. Bodhi, my teacher, he was called in by the family to a woman who was obviously dying, and she was in denial. So he went in and he said, "How are you doing?" She said, "I'm good." He says, "You don't look good. You look like you're dying." And she kicked him out. The family couldn't convince her to have him come back. So it's really a slippery slope if someone is actually in denial to get them to accept their death.
Yeah. My husband and I are in this sort of Zen tradition, which encourages people to reflect upon their impermanence as a way of like really embracing life as you have it. Have you found that there are certain cultures or traditions that are more accepting of death than others?
I haven't come in personal contact with that, but it makes so much sense that a religion or philosophy that concentrates on the impermanence of life gives you that, well, I'm alive. One of the things I say to myself every morning when I wake up is, wow, I woke up. Thank you.
Yeah.
And that sets the tone of my day.
I've read somewhere that the dying process is both universal and utterly unique. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yes, we all die. And all of a sudden we have a dead body. That's definitely universal. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. The way we go to our death is always unique. Like my best friend, when she died last year, she was in denial of her death. And it was really an awful death. I mean, I would try to talk to her and she'd say, all you want to do is talk about death. It's like, but it's coming. I didn't say that.
Right.
She didn't deal with her emotions, her pent up emotions about like a granddaughter was really estranged and had been not very nice to her. And she was just struggling and just, oh, it was just awful. And I told her daughter, the mother of the granddaughter, pulled her out of the room. I said, tell your mom that Erica called and she asked you for your forgiveness, that she loves you. So she went in the room and told her mom this. It was not the truth, but it was what she needed to hear. And she was dead within 6 hours.
Wow.
She was waiting for that.
So that's interesting. Like part of your process is helping people experience closure, even if that closure is not real.
Exactly.
What other sort of unconventional approaches have you encouraged?
When my sister-in-law was dying, she was going to be cremated. And she has 5 children and 8 grandchildren. And they all moved into her house for the last 3 weeks of her life. We were sleeping on floors, on couches, everywhere. And I said, let's bring our casket here. Because it was cardboard wrapped in linen. And I said, let's write on her casket and draw on her casket. So even her 3-year-old granddaughter was drawing pictures on this casket. And in the end, and she had teenagers to 3-year-old grandchildren, and one grandchild wrote, this end up. And, you know, precious cargo. You don't usually think about drawing on the casket.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really unique. And then we went to the crematorium, all of us. And her oldest grandson pushed her casket into the crematory and pushed the button to start the fire. And then we all sat in the crematorium until the burning was done and had breakfast and talked about her. So that's unusual.
Yeah, but it's beautiful. Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in. This podcast is only possible thanks to listener support. So please consider becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson. We often think of death as the opposite of life, the cessation of life, not a mode of being, but the absence of being.
But while death may be an absence, dying is a process. And that process is a part of life, one that is so transformative, it can change your sense of who you are while going through it.
I think that if you're conscious of your dying and you've accepted that death that's coming, it expands your spiritual being into total awareness. And in that awareness, every moment is precious. Touching your wife's hand or kissing someone's face or having them hug you. In the moment, it's just, I'm here, I'm dying, and this is what I have right now. That's the precious part of dying, if you can connect with that.
Do you have any thoughts on assisted suicide or death with dignity?
I have been with 2 people who have chosen that. And it's one of the bravest acts I've ever seen.
Hmm.
I'm just always amazed at the strength to drink the drink and say, this is it. Okay, bye-bye. And so whenever I talk about death, because it is an option, it's a legal option here. So luckily I get to offer it as a legal option. I let them know my experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
And another option is stopping eating and drinking.
Hmm.
Should you not want to do assisted suicide, but you want to just not continue living, that is another option. It's not as easy as one would think to stop eating and drinking, because your body
wants it. Yeah.
At least drinking.
Yeah.
Drinking is really super hard not to drink. And so if you choose that, you have to have a cohort of people who will not allow you to convince them to give you a drink.
Wow.
And that's really brave of the cohort.
Yeah. I wonder how you would recommend healthy living people prepare themselves for their own deaths.
Well, there are many things that you can do to prepare for your own death. The first is the paperwork. For sure, have an advanced care directive created. Advanced care directives let your loved ones know what it is that you want. Let's say you get in a car accident and you can no longer communicate. Do you want to be on life support for 15 years or do you not? And making some of those ahead of the event choices lets your family know what you want. Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to have a natural burial? What do you want? Because that's preparing yourself, getting your wants and desires in place, and it allows you to know that somebody will speak for you. In an advanced care directive, you choose two people, one person, the main person, then a secondary if that main person isn't available to make those choices for you. So that's the number one thing I would do, even at your age, Amanda,
right,
is to have that in place. Who's going to take your children? Should you both die? You know, because that happens.
Yeah.
But the advanced care directive is, I would say, the very first thing you want to have in place, because we're all going to die and we don't know when. And it can happen at any time. And the more you've thought about your death and prepared for it, the easier you can go to your death.
Before I get into some more personal things, what is your take on our sort of Western medicalized, institutionalized culture of death?
It's not very real. I think that medically, we want to keep everybody alive. And we'll go to all kinds of effort to keep someone alive when 200 years ago, they would have died. I mean, we're so deathophobic and youth-oriented that it's just not very, it's not real.
What are the deaths that have impacted you most in your life?
I've been at my stepfather's death, my father's death, my stepmother's death, my great aunt's death, and all of them affected me in a different way. Being with your family when they die it's super rich. That moment of death is so sacred. The death that's most impacted me is the death of my son. He was 28, and he died almost 5 years ago. He died in a boating accident, and he was the captain, and he got tossed out of the boat and drowned. I had already stepped into, I'm going to be a death doula, so it was just important. So we got a knock on the door at midnight, and come to Docton, there's been an accident. And we had had breakfast with him that morning, and he told me he was taking his friends and another boat of friends over to the Tacoma Dome for bull riding. And so they were all there, the two boats were coming back, and I thought, what kind of an accident? And my daughter, who lives on our property, came running down to the house, and she said, it's been just an accident. It's just an emergency. We have to go. I'm going, emergency? And in the back of my head, I already knew he was dead. So when we got there, and Dee Dee was dead, and he was in the A car, and it was after midnight, so the coroner couldn't come here. And we got to sit with him in the A car until 5:30 in the morning. His father, his stepfather, or his two sisters, and his sister's husband. And that was really special to sit with him and talk to him and yell at him and cry at him and sing songs to him. But the first thought I had when I walked in and I looked at him, I said, Justin, and I had just started talking about death with my kids, and they were going, Mom, we don't want to talk about it. Just like three nights before.
Wow. Wow.
And I looked at Justin and I said, Justin, I don't know what you want. You know, like, what do you want? Do you want to be buried? Do you want to be cremated? What? But luckily his girlfriend knew, so.
Wow. I mean, I know as a mom that would be like my worst nightmare. is part of your job to like help people also think through those contingencies? Like, okay, I'm going to prepare my children for my death. How do you prepare somebody for their children's death?
The thing I wish I had from Justin was a letter to me, because I've written letters to my children when I've had surgeries or I'm flying across the world. I write letters to everybody, and now my grandchildren all have letters in my will. I want to encourage parents to ask their adult children to write them letters. That's one step of preparation. Part of me doesn't want to prepare any parent for their child's death because it's just the worst. And the other part of me says, yes, it's always a potential reality and it sucks.
How do you want to die?
I have it all written up.
Yeah, I bet you do.
I want to die at home. Mm-hmm. And I want to die with certain music playing.
You have a soundtrack picked out.
Yes. And I want everybody to be around me, to be holding me, touching me. And I want to be pain-free as much as possible. And sometimes when you're pain-free, you're not fully here anymore because it's dulled you out. And I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I'd rather be pain-free than suffering. I have things I want to complete. I want to get all my stuff in order for my kids so they know what's important to keep. I want to label everything so they know this is my great-grandmother's. And it was, so it's your great-great-grandmother's or your great-great-great-grandmother's. I mean, I have a account set aside for funeral and celebration money so that it's free and they get to have access to it. I guess getting my stuff in order is really the thing that is weighing on my shoulders right now.
How does working with death affect your life?
It makes me really happy to be alive. It brings me joy in every moment because I know that I'm going to die and I don't know when. And I don't want to waste my time with anger and angst and pettiness. I want to live my life with joy and openness and kindness. I mean, if you really face your death, meditate on it, that transition is so sacred. Honor it and be ready to acknowledge that it's happened and take your time. Take your time. There's no rush.
After Susan left us that day, we found ourselves reticent to leave the vocal booth.
Conversations about death have a way of anchoring you in your body.
So we decided to have a conversation between the two of us, one that was probably long overdue.
Death. What a happy subject.
Do you have a vision of how you want to die?
I mean, it's a luxury to ask that question, right? Because it presumes you're not hit by a bus.
Well, sure. But regardless of all of those things, like in your ideal world, how would you like to die?
I've thought about my funeral a bit, which is a different but related question. How I would actually go out. At one point in time, I might have answered like, that's the time to really try heroin. You know, like feel that pure ecstasy that you, I personally have not done opium or heroin. A part of me is really drawn to wondering what that kind of bliss feels like, but I'm also quite scared knowing I have a kind of an addictive personality. And
yeah, you're not allowed to have try heroin.
Right. But if I was on my deathbed, maybe, maybe that's the time.
Go for it.
You know, I don't think that's my answer today.
Really?
Yeah. I think given my experiences with psychedelics and meditation, I'm much more likely to want to be present and as clear-eyed as possible because I can imagine that experience being transcendent. You know, you're only going to get that experience once. What's it like to die? Don't you want to know, even if you get to know for just a, you know, half a second or not quite know, like trying to catch your own reflection in the mirror?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is there are so many different ways to die, even if the way that you choose is at home in your own bed, right? Like, are you aware or not aware? Are you conscious or not conscious? Are you in pain? Are you not in pain? Are you surrounded by people who love you, or are you alone? Have you thought about it at length beforehand, mm-hmm. or does it catch you by surprise?
Yeah.
So the most recent death in my life has honestly seemed like one of the best deaths you could have, which was my grandpa. He died last August, and it was the day after his birthday. All of his family came to visit him on his birthday. We had a fun, casual time. All the neighbors came over to say hi with their dogs. And he like hung out outside in the sunshine after having gone in the morning into town to have a nice pancake breakfast where the waitress kissed him on the cheek because it was his birthday. And then he, at the end of the day, went to bed and never woke up. And as far as deaths go, that sounds kind of great in the sense that, like, it's even kind of perfect that it was the day after his birthday. So he could be like, I was 91, not 90, you know, you know, like there's something sort of perfectly marvelous about that. And that day that I was hanging out with him, he talked about dying almost as if he knew.
Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of how I would like to go. And to be clear, like, it's not like people around you are watching you die. Like, I think that's the one thing that being super aware and everyone around you being super aware is, like, it can be really sad. And there's something kind of wonderful about the way my grandpa did it, where we were all there to celebrate his life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just, in the intimacy and privacy of his own world that night, went away. And it's a little bit in contrast to what you were talking about as being like hyper aware and really present for it. And on the one hand, I'm drawn to that. And on the other hand, a part of me is like, but also it would be really nice to just go to sleep super happy and content. And that's the last thing you felt.
I mean, if you could outsource this to some hitman or mad scientist and just be like, you know, when I'm after one of these conditions are met, when I'm approximately so old, when my health is deteriorating, and when I have a really, really happy day and then go to sleep, that's when I want you to do it. So you won't actually know. I mean, like,
you're the worst. You had to go to hitman. Like,
okay. I think my point here is that, you know, you don't get to choose unless you choose. And so that's a beautiful way that your grandpa went out. He did seem to be talking on his last day about his mortality and about how he'd had a good run and things like that. Did he somehow intuitively know his body was going to give out that night?
Yes, obviously you can't choose.
But, well, you can choose if you choose to go out on your own terms, if you take some hemlock, you know? And one way of doing this is to say, okay, well, I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I've got several months to live. I'm 91, right? One option is to do every treatment in the book and ruin my quality of life and, you know, slowly deteriorate and live another few months. Or I throw a big party. I invite all my friends over and we all let them know that at the end of the night, I'm going to die.
I think what you would want is to give people the option to be there, because I think it matters both to the person who's dying and to the people who love that person, mm-hmm. whether or not they want to be there for that specific thing.
But I think there's something about, like, even just the decision is not quite the same as if you say swallowed the medication and you knew that it would take effect in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've gone through the doorway, you've boarded the train, you can't get off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's it got to be like to live through that 2 hours knowing that it's going to end? It's got to be super fascinating.
Would you do Zazen, or would you want to be talking to Echo and Eureka and me? Assuming you're going to die before me, because you're probably
are. Yeah, we should talk about that. Yeah, I mean, I've thought, do I want to just meditate and pay attention to my sensations as I die? I mean, maybe in my very, very last moments, maybe. Do I want to write a Japanese death poem? Kind of.
Yeah, knowing you.
But, you know, in the hours and minutes leading up to that final moment, yeah, of course I'd want to be talking to my loved ones, you know?
Oh my God, there's going to be a last poem you write.
Yeah, there's going to be a last
poem I write.
Yeah, that's true. I hope it's a good one. It'll be probably pretty good.
It's going to be great.
Are you thinking about, are you getting sad now because you're imagining that I'm going to die before you?
Yeah, I'm definitely imagining that I'm going to be there watching you die.
Yeah, it's probably true. How do you feel about that?
Fucked up. I mean, by then, Echo and Eureka will be old enough that, like, we'll be able to sort of carry each other through that. That's really intense for me. What would end up happening if I were to die before you is I would probably get really ill, or there'd be some kind of accident.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way that I'm not living longer than you. Have you thought about that?
If you died first?
Yeah. Or are you just like, I'm obviously going to die first, but I mean, you never know.
I'm 5 years older than you and I'm a man.
Yeah.
The odds are greatly in favor of you living longer than me.
Unless I get some kind of disease.
Unless you get some kind of disease or some terrible accident. I don't know if I'm just bad at imagining that right now or if I'm really zen right now, but it would be tough. But it's not like bringing me to tears, you know? I love you.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I love our children too. And I'm not, like, it would be crushing. It's really hard for me to imagine. Maybe that's what it is. I mean, if you outlive your child, right, what a horrible death to have to witness.
Yeah, that would be, I don't know how people recover from that.
But, you know, we're both atheists and it's over when it's over for us. You know, there's no mollifying, there's no comforting thoughts of I'll reunite with you in heaven. Weirdly, that is comforting for me.
Mm.
You're here until you're not, you know, you're... Atoms disperse and take new shapes and patterns and become a part of other organic systems.
Let's talk then about dying and not like the moment of death, but like I think there is something really fascinating to the idea of what we can do while we're alive to really acknowledge and embrace the fact of your death, even if you don't know what it's going to eventually actually look like. Death could happen at any time, but more importantly than that, the longer you've thought about your own death and really let that sink in, not only the more prepared you are for when it actually comes down, but also the better you've lived your life. I think the vast majority of us sort of live our lives in a state of denial about death. And so as a result of that, we end up sort of putting off life until we get the things that we want in order to live. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate reality is that that is not what life or death is. And you hear all these like terrible stories about like people who die, you know, a year after they retire or a year after they get out of prison. And you think, oh my God, they only had a year of life. And it's like, well, they only had a year of life if they were waiting to live until they retired or until they got out of prison. And I think that's the most devastating mistake that a person can make is squandering mentally or spiritually or emotionally the life that you are currently living, which is the only life that you can absolutely be certain about.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Tim Urban's chart from Wait But Why of the boxes of how many weeks or days you have left statistically to just kind of visualize and put in perspective like, oh, okay, well, if I have dinner with my parents once every month or once every 2 weeks. And if I'm going to live, and if they're going to live statistically this long, I've only got 26 more dinners with my parents or something, mm-hmm. right? It's not that many.
Mm-hmm.
How many times am I going to kiss Eureka on the forehead before tucking her in at night? You know, even just thinking about her aging
mm-hmm.
up out of that behavior, it's easier to appreciate the life you're living now when you remind yourself of how fleeting it is.
What do you think about bucket lists?
It's a good question. I have never really been drawn to the idea of a bucket list. How about you?
On the one hand, that feels like such a consumerist way to live. You're literally collecting life experiences
mm-hmm.
in order to like prove that you lived to yourself. But on the other hand, it's being mindful about what experiences you're choosing for yourself versus just sort of letting life happen to you. And I think taking a moment to ask yourself, is there something I want to experience in this life and what can I do to facilitate that experience is a worthy question.
I think the funny odor on that idea maybe has to do with chasing after experience as opposed to accepting your life as it is. It's both, right? Like the end of suffering and your peace and fulfillment in life is a result of both accepting your life for what it is, but also acknowledging that you can do things to change your life mm-hmm. or to change your experience at the same time. So yeah, you want to go see the Grand Canyon or you want to try mescaline, you know, or eat at the best sushi restaurant in the world, whatever it is. All that stuff is cool. And I think the thing that can maybe taint it is if you treat that like, I have to do this stuff before I die. Mm. And the idea of the bucket list sort of rings that way for me, as opposed to like, well, today, if all I do is sit here and drink some tea and read some poems and look out the window at some birds, like that could be an amazing day if you're present in the right way,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not going to be
jumping out of an airplane.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess also the bucket list is sort of peak experience focused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with peak experiences, but if you're always grasping at the next peak experience, is that what's wrong with it?
Yeah, I mean, life is not made of, as much as the peak end rule affects how we remember life, actual life is not lived in the peak experiences. It's lived in the many, many troughs between those, right?
Mm.
So if you're not fulfilled in all those troughs and you're just waiting for the next crest, doesn't sound like a good recipe for having a great life.
Mm.
You're just planning, you're just living in the future, right? If you're checking off your list, it's like, okay, now I got to figure out how to backpack through Venezuela.
Hmm. I'm a little torn on this one.
Which is not to say don't go seek out peak experiences, but I think you have to do it in such a way that you're also really valuing and enjoying your life between them, and to acknowledge the value of seeking out non-peak experiences. Like later today, we're going to go to a Japanese tea ceremony. It's not going to be like jumping out of an airplane, but I'm really looking forward to it. So do you want to talk about your funeral? How does that relate to this?
I mean, the funeral is the experience for your loved ones after your death. So I think what I would like from a funeral is for there to be one last opportunity for my family to experience my personality and my values and to like share in that. In the same way that like we designed our wedding to be a really fun experience for our audience, but also to reflect our personalities. So we're like, look, you know, this may not be your style of wedding, but you're getting into costume and you're going to play along solving puzzles with us. And now that I think about it, maybe our funerals should involve puzzle making, puzzle solving and costumes.
It hadn't occurred to me, but an escape room funeral.
Yeah. Right? Sounds amazing. I kind of am in love with that. And if along the way there can be moments of pause, just like in our wedding when we did really good vows,
mm-hmm.
like you want moments of pause where people can reflect and people can learn from each other, even new facets of the person who's gone because of the sharing of like stories or whatever. I think I would also like to pick out some readings.
Hmm.
ahead of time that talk about what I think about life and what I think about death, just to give like some touchstones to the people I left behind of like how I've thought about death and what has been comforting to me.
It's so interesting. Most of the funerals I've been to, that job falls to someone close to the person who died.
Mm-hmm.
What should we read at the funeral, right? And so often that person is, you know, prepared and they default to scripture or,
right.
You know, they default to quoting words they found on a quote site. I've been to some sad funerals like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a result of the death denial. Everyone, it's unexpected, even though it shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
Right. And the person who is heading toward the void would have had time to think about all those things, but chose not to.
But wouldn't it be amazing if like there was already a script written?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the poems. Here's the readings. So it's not just, you know, your family having to dig through all your crap and figure out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they've got everything is sort of laid out for them to make it as easy for them as they pick up the broken pieces of the life you left behind in a material sense.
We probably don't need to get into this, but technology is offering people ways to transcend death. I think we're pretty close now to the ability to replicate what was in that Black Mirror episode using large language models trained on, you know, all your written material and known, you know, for us, like so much audio and writing we've done, like we'd probably be able to create a convincing chatbot that talked like you.
That'd be creepy.
People are going to be doing that stuff very soon. I think there's already companies working on that. And, you know, one option is at your funeral, you get a talk to chatbot Amanda. How does it feel to be dead?
You know? I don't think so. I don't think I want chatbot Amanda. Also, you wouldn't ask chatbot Amanda what it feels like to be dead.
That's true.
She's not dead.
Now, what about going out together?
Ah, the old drinking the wine, the
yeah.
Like aspirin-laced wine together.
That's probably not aspirin, but...
Whatever it is. That's an interesting way to go. Is it legal?
That's a separate question. Who knows what the laws are going to be when we're 90? But let's say it was legal, and we were able to source the things we needed. Like, would you, rather than, you know, watching me die and then being a widow for a while, if you were already at a ripe old age, you know, if you were 95, if I made it to 95 and it was clear I was going to die in the next month or two, would you want to like go out with me?
I think the answer to this is that I'm going to keep living because my job is not going to be done after that.
What's your job?
Helping our kids transition to life without a father. I feel like I need to teach them how to prepare for my own death by helping guide them through saying goodbye to you. And I think it'd be too much to leave them orphaned suddenly with neither of us there to help.
Hmm.
So I feel like, sorry, love, I got shit to do. I gotta be a mom.
Yeah, you never stop being a mom, do you?
Never stop being a mom. If you're anything like us, we're guessing you don't have your own death plan worked out. What better time than now to start thinking about how you want your life to end?
Not just for your own sake, but for your family. What experience do you want them to have? These questions are hard to ask, but important questions usually are.
Thanks for getting lost with us. Find us on Twitter, at Amanda Knox.
At Man Under Bridge.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at knoxrobinson.com. And I'm not dying yet, I promise. But if I were, my deathbed request would be, please, leave Labyrinths a 5-star review and spread the word on social media. Your word of mouth keeps this podcast kicking.
Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us and Jasper Merrill, with theme music by Josh Budo Karp.
Fun fact, for every hour of Labyrinths you enjoy, we put in dozens of hours researching, outreaching, interviewing, scripting, editing, and audio engineering.
What keeps us going?
Coffee. So if you're enjoying Labyrinths, please buy us a coffee.
Head over to patreon.com/KnoxRobinson, where you can make a monthly donation.
Thanks for getting lost with us.